Hey, man.
Hey.
Hey, everybody.
Happy Friday to you.
Oh, yeah, it is Friday, huh? Good. Oh, yeah. That's right, because I was just talking about how I got to find somebody to interview for the KPFK show tonight. I'm tempted to just interview somebody about the MEK again. But nah. I shouldn't pick on those guys too much. They're the little guys. I just like pointing out that...
Pick on their
America
spokesman.
America uses... a communist terrorist cult against their enemies. Isn't that funny? But it's not their fault that they're a communist terrorist cult. It's just funny that they are. Like, what the hell? What a bunch of kooks. They'll show up in your comment section and go crazy, dude. Anyway. They're in trouble. Yeah, find somebody. Anyway, so, yeah, welcome to the show. Jason Leopold will be back on the show. Because the DHS was watching the Occupy people. And so he's going to tell us all about that. He's got a new piece at truthout.org about it. And a lady named either Dinah or Dina, Rasser or Razor, is going to be on the show to talk about Lockheed. Lockheed, yeah. She's got a couple of pieces there. One of them's from last December about the F-35. Specifically about the F-35. And then this one is Lockheed, the ultimate pay-to-play contractor. Which is a very nice way of saying fascist warmongering enterprise. So I expect her to be a very polite person on the show. Look forward to talking with her. Yeah. So, that's pretty good, right? Oh, they're making fun of me for not being able to pronounce people's names right. Well, why should I be able to? Just because my government has an empire doesn't mean I gotta study every language in the world and get all the accents right or even pay attention in vocabulary class in junior high school or... anything like that.
You had a vocabulary class in junior high school?
No, I don't know. Probably like a section. I think there was reading. That's what they called it. Whatever. I always could read well. I talk a lot, but the quality leaves some to be desired, you know. Sorry. All right, so I don't know. It's kind of disappointing to me that of all the complaining I do on this show, the thing that's gotten the most attention, at least lately, is complaining about Rand Paul and Jesse Benton. You know, I only brought up Rand Paul just to point out that Jesse Benton's plan to somehow, you know, make a career for himself if he couldn't figure out a way to get Rand Paul elected to... or appointed to some cabinet position or another, or something like that, that wouldn't work in bringing the Ron Paul people into the Romney fold anyway. He wouldn't be able to live up to his end of the deal because Rand Paul is no good. That's all. And, you know, I went off all half-cocked and I hadn't had enough coffee. Maybe it'll be my excuse. How about that? I didn't sit down and go, okay... there's a very important issue, which is the, not just right-wing, but stupid nature of the, every part of the Paul campaign except Paul, I guess. And something's got to be done about it, like the guy responsible for it all ought to have to step down and be replaced by somebody else. And sit and think of this. Here's how I'll say it. Here's how I'll make my case. In fact, now I'm kind of worried that, like, maybe Ron Paul won't like me anymore if he hears what a jerk I am and the terrible things I said about his boy. But you know what? What are you going to do? Fact is, Rand Paul's horrible, man. You vote for Rand sanctions, you're a terrible person to me. I don't have an honest difference of opinion about politics with you. I denounce you and think you're a terrible, horrible person. Now, being a regular civilian and supporting somebody like that... that's a difference of opinion, and I strongly disagree with yours. But but actually being a senator in the U.S. Senate and voting for sanctions against Iran, as there's a push by very powerful people to start a war there, when sanctions only make matters worse, and there's hardly any example of exceptions to that, except maybe South Africa that one time. But anyway, to be in the Senate to vote for sanctions against Iran now means you're the devil. I mean, hell, what does the Senate do all day except to demonize people? Well, I demonize them. What the hell right do they have to be the Senate anyway? And so that's why I think that, you know, Jesse Benton's announcement that we don't have a deal with the Romney people, but we really want one, is really stupid. And especially when they're floating, getting Rand Paul, the son, a job. When, you know, some Ron Paulians support him and they'll, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt or whatever. Try to overlook his his problems. And he's got a few of them. But he just doesn't inspire the love and the loyalty that Ron Paul inspires. Hell, for 30 years you've had, you know, punk rockers and bankers who thought Ron Paul is the one who understands. You know? This whole time he's had this cult following of every kind of person. Every kind of, so-called character you could come up with or whatever. Has found a hero in Ron Paul. Show me the hero in Rand. Well, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, a far left-wing position is to do nothing, and so we got to do something, and so instead of having a war, we shouldn't have a war, but we should do these sanctions. Oh, yeah. You know, if only he gets a job as, director of Homeland Security, or maybe Housing and Urban Development, Transportation, something like that. Boy, then that'll be like the Ron Paul Revolution succeeded and was great, huh? Think people are going to get on board for that? So, really, I wasn't even addressing Rand Paul. I wasn't trying to. I just sometimes go off on tangents. My real point was about Jesse Benton. And it's not personal. I've never met the guy. I don't know the guy. I'm just saying he's not good enough to be running the Ron Paul campaign. And that's not just bad choices of commercials, where instead of choosing to highlight the heroic and brilliant and far-sighted and decent and just nature of their candidate, you know, all the appealing things about him, they tried to run him as a flash animation cartoon against everyone by just demonizing everyone else. Which, you don't have to waste your resources demonizing Newt Gingrich. He's on tour, man. And the more he talks, the more people don't like him. You don't even have to campaign against him at all. He's already done. And anyway, not just for that, but just look at the ground game and whatever. You know, I see the rumors going around on Facebook. Geez, we really tried to work with the campaign on helping us out a little bit, and boy, did they botch it this way and that way. And some people complained, oh, they overdid it, man. We knew who we were dealing with, and we were treating them with kid gloves, trying to bring some of these, former Perryites onto the Ron Paul thing and whatever. And then came the bum rush, the ignorant one, and pissed them all off and whatever. And then other things, we couldn't get any help at all and whatever. And then just look, they haven't delivered a single state. And you know what? I think, I can't prove it, but I speculate that, man, they stole a state or two from Ron, at least. I think they did. But you know what? It's still failures, because he should have been so far ahead that they couldn't steal it. You know, you can only steal it if it's within a point or two. Get away with it. But anyway, so sorry for being so rough, but that's where I stand on it. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and Jason Leopold is coming up on the show here in just a few. And then later on, Dina Razor will be here to talk about Lockheed. And or I have a rehash where you guys could hear how one time back in 2007, I interviewed a guy named Richard Cummings, who wrote a book, and he was a Lou Rockwell type of guy. Had some pieces for LRC. And he wrote this piece for Playboy that I think they chickened out, and they ended up only putting it at Playboy.com due to their cowardly fear. And anyway, still they ran at Playboy.com. You could also find it at CorpWatch.org to protect your virgin eyeball holes. You know, I wouldn't want you
to see all that airbrushing
cleavage on their front page, you know.
All that CGI.
Yeah. So, if you go to corpwatch.org, you can read it. The article is called Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And it's a great story. It's a story about how, first of all, Lockheed made this plane that I can never remember the name of back in the 70s that was supposed to compete with the DC-10 and the 737 and whatever. I'm making up the specifics because I don't exactly know. But it was supposed to be, you know, not a super jumbo jet 747 type thing, but a couple of levels smaller than that commuter jet, and nobody wanted it. They spent billions developing it, and nobody wanted it. So they wasted billions on the technology, right, on developing the thing and making the first few and whatever. So they had a big crisis meeting, and they decided, from now on, let's just sell the military, because the military can spend as much money as they want because it's not their money. And they really, you know, are partners with this central banking system that can print as much money as anybody might need to buy our crap. So let's just have the military for a customer. And that was what they decided. And then they had another meeting, and they decided, you know what? We really better help determine what America's foreign policy is. That way we know which weapons to build, you know, so we can make more money. And so they set about on, you know, not just lobbying for we ought to get this contract and that one, but lobbying for which priorities ought to take precedence in maintaining America's global empire. That way they would know what kind of weapons to make. Not that they do that. I mean, you look at the history of the last 10 years of war, and they're always having to, you know, invent new kinds of hell. They put the guys out there in aluminum Humvees in the Iraq war, going up against IEDs in an aluminum little truck, where you put them in a Ford Ranger, at least it's made out of metal. I mean, aluminum's metal, but not really. Not compared to a Ford Ranger. You know what I mean? For crying out loud.
Driving around in a soda can.
Yeah. But anyway, that was their policy. And here's the whole real point of Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels by Richard Cummings, which you can read at corpwatch.org, in which you can hear me interview him back in 2007 at antiwar.com. The real point is all the neocons are tied to Lockheed. Like, not just, you know, I'm not saying Francis Fukuyama, which maybe he is, I don't know. But the political neocons, not all of the writers and whatever, Krutammer and whatever, but the actual political appointee types, Wolfowitz and Libby, and we're talking the first Bush first Bush Jr. administration, right? Wolfowitz, Libby, Wurmser, Feith, and Shulsky, and even Hadley, who was the deputy national security advisor under Condoleezza Rice and then became national security advisor. He was a lawyer for Lockheed. His law firm was a Lockheed law firm. And, you know, they all were tied to Lockheed. And so then this became the basis of Cummings' thesis that the war in Iraq never was really about oil or Israel. It was all just about selling Lockheed crap to the Pentagon at your expense, and how the whole shock and awe operation was nothing but a Lockheed. I think I'm not making this up. Maybe I'm conflating the shock and awe exactly with another statement. But it was basically that the whole initial invasion was like a Lockheed promotional video. Then we'll deploy our Lockheed brand, you know, this kind of tank and that kind of A-10 Warthog and this kind of everything else. The Javelin missiles and the JDAM bombs and the long-range bombers and the stealth fighters and the everything is just one big Lockheed promotional video commercial. you know, like they would produce to show generals. And that became like the battle plan for the attack on Iraq. And good old Jackson. Is it Bruce Jackson? Something's telling me I might not have the name right. I think it's Bruce Jackson. He became the head of the, first of all, in the 90s, the committee to come up with excuses to expand NATO into Eastern Europe. Because for every country we bring into NATO, they get a giant Lockheed package of fighter jets, right? So that's all they cared about. And then he also came up with the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which specialized not in weapons of mass destruction lies, but in propaganda hyping up the, at that time, almost 20-year-old, now 30-year-old, Anfal campaign of Saddam Hussein's, you know, mass murder of 100,000 Kurds, and bringing up really old stuff from back when Saddam Hussein was a loyal stooge of the Reagan-Bush administration in the 1980s, you know. But I mean, true stuff. But they specialize in propagandizing about what a horrible tyrant Saddam was in the run-up to the war in 03. And anyway, so this guy Bruce Cummings just got their number and wrote this great article about it. And well, I'd like to say it's been an interest of mine in any real sense. Like, I tried to go out and find as many books about it as I could or something like that. It's not true. But I should have. And this lady, Dina Razor, coming up on the show, apparently she's written about it this whole time. She wrote The Pentagon Underground, Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatized War, Courage Without Martyrdom, A Survival Guide for Whistleblowers, and More Bucks, Less Bang, How the Pentagon Buys Ineffective Weapons, back in 1983. So, this is some interesting stuff. For 10 years, she directed the Washington, D.C. Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that she founded, and its work with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and the defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. Wow, maybe I should just have her on for an hour and just let her talk the whole time and not say anything at all. And just say, tell me everything that you know about Washington, D.C. You know, is that broad enough? Go ahead, start talking. I'll tell you when you got to stop. So this should be interesting. What a good time. Coming up on the show. Okay, I mentioned the MEK, so let me just mention again one more thing about the MEK. Terrorist groups supporters throw party in the U.S. Congress. By Josh Rogan. Remember, it was a big deal, and it should have been a big deal, when a bunch of congressmen showed up for the coronation of Reverend Sung Young Moon as a demigod or whatever the hell. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Here's the Mujahideen Ikalk in the Congress. In the hearing room of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Doubling down on their push to get delisted. After it was announced that the other terrorists, the Treasury Department, is looking into what they're up to. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And our first guest today comes from Truth Out. It's Jason Leopold. DHS turns over Occupy Wall Street documents to Truth Out. Really? Why would they even bother? What were you going to do about it? Welcome back to the show. Sorry,
hey,
I'm always surprised when the government complies with some demand of a citizen.
Well, I have to say, Scott, I filed probably about nearly 100 FOIA requests last year. Much of that has to do with issues revolving around national security, counterterrorism, torture, etc. I haven't really received much, and in fact, I'm still waiting for some of those to be processed. So I was quite surprised that DHS, Department of Homeland Security, turned over the first batch of documents, which total about 400 pages related to Occupy Wall Street. And there's a lot of interesting, important information in there. And I just want to note that in a few weeks they're scheduling another release. Of documents. So they actually have quite a bit of information. Their info is redacted throughout these documents, but
So what are they following, some acolytes of the blind sheikh around, making sure that they don't hurt the American peaceful protesters?
Yeah, well, you know, these it leaves no question, put it this way, that Department of Homeland Security was closely monitoring Occupy Wall Street, the movement from the days that the very first day that it started. There were threat assessments in there. There was even some reports from the Secret Service. The Secret Service monitored the protest on September 17th and put together a little case summary. There is information that in there showing that there was some activity happening in Pittsburgh, in which they put a threat assessment together there. What's very interesting is that there's actually some people within the Department of Homeland Security who were skittish about what the agency was doing with regard to Occupy Wall Street, and verbalized their concern by stating that they feared that some of these actions rose to the level of unauthorized surveillance. Many of the fusion centers, felt that, they needed intelligence or wanted intelligence, fusion centers, which were scattered throughout the country. So they would, send notes or emails to, headquarters asking for, quote, intelligence products, on Occupy Wall Street. And I will say that, some of the more top, senior officials, within the agency said, look, we're not supposed to do this. This is not our job. So when you get requests like this from fusion centers, you just tell them that, no, this is a local law enforcement matter. So you could see within the documents that they struggled. What's very interesting, though, first let me just point out what's also very important is statements to the media that are in these documents are carefully worded. One of the most important for the people who have been monitoring Occupy Wall Street, one of the, their most important pieces of information for them was to find out whether the agency was involved in that crackdown that took place in October. What appeared to be a coordinated crackdown of Occupy encampments. And the protests throughout the country, there was, I think, within about a dozen or so cities. And it was very, very violent, if you recall. And so people speculated that this had to be coordinated with the Department of Homeland Security.
Right.
So the documents say that first let me just point out there's no smoking gun in the documents that say or that shows the, that the agency was involved in that. But there are more documents to come, so who knows? But it does, show that Federal Protective Services were Protective Service was on the scene. And many of these protests, they were the documents say the only one that they were involved in was
what the hell is the Federal Protective Services? I've never even heard of that one. I don't think.
Yeah, it's the vehicles that you see, or that if you've heard that there's any vehicles out there with Department of Homeland Security, it's basically. They're the folks that monitor, what takes place on, if there's anything that's happening on federal property, federal.
They're security for government buildings, basically.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
I got you.
They're part of the agency, and it, the other thing that these documents show, Scott, is that it's such a Department of Homeland Security. What a massive bureaucracy! Massive. The fact that you have so many different offices within this agency that some people don't know, frankly, what their job is, what they're supposed to do. The Department of Homeland Security is supposed to monitor threats, threats to the homeland. That's basically what it says on their website. There are some people that felt like, hey, look, there's a protest happening. There's a movement that's being organized, and we should have intelligence on them, and we should be able to do that. And, you know, as I indicated, they're not supposed to do that, but some within the agency felt that they are. And then you get to the point where you, in these documents, where you have the media contacting the agency to find out what their role was within the, you know, within this crackdown. And, you know, these spokespeople at the agency, you know, have no idea. So, you know, they're sending notes back and forth to higher ups and saying, well, how would we describe our activities with Occupy Wall Street? You know, they're getting the responses and giving the media carefully worded statements misleading them a bit, providing information on background. And then later you see that that these reporters, you know, simply published it wholesale.
Well, can you share with us a little bit more specifically some of those statements?
Sure. It's, you know, there were some inquiries that right around November, there were inquiries that were that they received from CBS, Associated Press, AP, Reuters. And I'm just, you know, bringing this up on the documents. And again, these inquiries were simply, you know, the media inquiries were, what does, you know, is the Department of Homeland Security involved in the crackdown? And then, you know, the spokespeople would write to their bosses or the higher ups and basically say, what should we say? And these, you know, statements said, the Department of Homeland Security is not involved in, you know, in any coordinated crackdown with Occupy Wall Street. If anything takes place on federal land, and then only to ensure the safety of individuals, then, you know, that's when we will step in. But we leave this as a law enforcement matter. And then on background, law enforcement meaning local law enforcement, and then on background, they would provide the reporters with information. Federal Protective Services was involved in only one crackdown, and that was in Portland. Because it, you know, something took place on federal property there.
And yeah, that's that annoying bumper music coming in here. We got to go out and take this break, but we'll be right back on the other side with Jason Leopold from truthout.org. He got a giant pile of Homeland Security documents through the Freedom of Information Act all about their surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street protest move. We'll be right back. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Got Jason Leopold on the line from truthout.org. The article is DHS turns over Occupy Wall Street documents to Truthout, and there's a link to the actual files right there at the top of the page for you. And go write your own article all about it if you want. This is it has a flavor of being continually updated as we learn more, as we continue sifting through this thing together. Pretty quick summary of what you have in the documents. Where were we when the music started
playing?
Yeah,
this was it's being updated regularly, and you know, we're putting out some separate reports as well. And you know, we were talking about, you know, what some of these statements were to the media, and you know, internally what some of the DHS officials told the public affairs office was, you know, when these calls came into, you know, what are you guys doing? Are you involved with the crackdown? And, you know, one statement here says, quote, we are working with GSA, General Services Administration, which is the agency that approves permits for protests on federal property. We are working with GSA and each city government to ensure that all parties concerned are safe and secure. DHS has held standard coordination calls and face-to-face meetings with our partners to ensure that the proper resources are available for operations, such as street closures, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That, you know, again, what can one take from that statement, which is basically, you know, they're
It's deniability. They're, yeah, we were there, but we were doing a different mission than
exactly.
You know.
Exactly. And then, you know, and then in one case, and this is again, you know, with a carefully worded statement where, you know, specifically, were you involved, were you DHS involved in the crackdown? And, you know, one of the officials says, this is not taking place in any wholesale manner. So, again, you know, it's reporters would take that, reprint it, and, you know, not really dig into what that, you know, what that means, you know, any wholesale manner. So, you know, that it certainly does indicate that something was happening. And, you know, during the protests and you know, many folks were tweeting about these vehicles that they saw. And some of the vehicles, you know, as I indicated, were, you know, Federal Protective Service. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew exactly, you know, why they were there. But these documents indicate now that, well, they were there specifically because they were monitoring the protesters, monitoring the activities, and you know, putting together, as I indicated, threat assessments in some cities, and you know, where Occupy, they felt that there was a threat. So. It's very interesting to see that, you know, this is still taking place. The response has been, to some of these revelations. Well, that's what the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to do. You know, Scott, we've spoken about this before. The public seems to be accepting, for the most part, of, hey, this is the way it is. This is what our government does. And they're supposed to, you know, monitor for, you know, for threats. No, they're not supposed to do that. They're not supposed. Well, at least, you know, dissent. You know, this was monitoring in some cases to suppress, the First Amendment constitutionally protected, you know, rights of these processors and the, you know, their First Amendment rights. So,
well, and you know, the government doesn't have any claim on this level of paranoia at all, as though the Occupy Wall Street movement was about to turn into, you know, the riot in Cairo that overthrew Mubarak or something and brings down the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Like, this is the first Red Scare and, you know,
right.
Massive strikes crippling the nation's economy. It's nothing like this at all. It's a protest movement of disaffected Democrats who have good reason to be disaffected, but who are basically up to nothing.
Right.
No offense.
Right. Exactly.
You know. But,
no offense taken. Let me just
so
say
the
that,
cops'
you know,
job is protecting their rights. That's it. This is America, and so the cops are there to provide security because that's the only excuse they have for existing. Other than that, what is this? Unless they have an Al-Qaeda threat to the poor innocent protesters, why do the feds have any involvement whatsoever?
Well,
it's a NYPD matter.
Right, yeah. It's true. In fact, I have filed an Open Records Act request with NYPD to try to get some of those documents. I actually think that those documents, those materials, whatever they have internally, would be, the materials that are more revelatory in terms of what's happening. And, you know, let me just point out that just about an hour ago, there was a report that came out about NYPD infiltrating, you know, what's what the news organization characterizes as liberal groups. So, these are new revelations that, this activity has been taking place and, within the past couple of years. But
yeah,
again,
I'm sorry.
I hope
I didn't sound like I was implying local means not corrupt or anything. Just
no, I don't think you're implying that at all. Think that in the big picture for me, you know, what's important here or what I'm interested in and what I want to impress upon, you know, my readers is that, first of all, you know, the use of the Freedom of Information Act. It's actually a very important tool, and it can be, you know, when used properly, a powerful tool. And as such, you know, I used it in order to, you know, pry loose, you know, information that otherwise may not have been revealed publicly. So that's important, and it shows what our government is up to and what the taxpayer dollars are being used for. And when we look at all this historically, though, in a historical context, this is nothing new. And, you more or less indicated that. This, first of all, this type of activity, monitoring, has been going on for decades. It's interesting. One can just go onto the, FBI's website and look at all their old records about, the spying on the anti-war movement. So, this has been taking place for decades. What's interesting again to me now is the massive bureaucracy, this behemoth of a federal agency, the power that they have, the money that they have, the money that they're that they're using and wasting, and to put together these assessments and on whether this movement will turn into a threat, when there are obviously perhaps some legitimate, threats out there. So, and I understand that when you have something this size, that you do have to pay attention to it. I think that what was happening here, they were going a little bit. In some cases, some folks were trying to go beyond that, and it's one of the other pieces of information within the documents that stood out to me is the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They wanted information as to whether any federal law enforcement officer had confiscated or if they've seen information about whether any of these protesters carried quote Molotov cocktails, guns, knives, unconventional and conventional weapons. They were very interested in that. Obviously, perhaps they can.
Yeah, they just want to get their camel nose into the tent. That's all.
Right, exactly. So, it's all. I think that the whole thing is just when you look at this in the big picture, should anyone be surprised? No, I think part of the surprise out there is that. Or in the documents is the fact that there was dissent within the agency as to what they were doing. There were people that actually felt that they were crossing the line. I will point out, however, that these individuals noted in some of their emails that quote, they've just learned that the emails and some of the information that they've been disseminating was subject to a FOIA request. So they were very conscious of, of what they were doing, what they were saying that would eventually become public, or could become public. So, it's worth noting.
Right. Yeah. Plant a little exculpatory evidence in there for themselves for later. And Jason Leopold's going to come knocking from truthout.org.
Right. Right.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot for your time, man. I really appreciate it. And your work.
Appreciate it, Scott. Have a great weekend.
You too, man. All right, everybody, that's the great Jason Leopold, truthout.org. DHS turns over some Occupy Wall Street documents. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I got Zoe Greif on mic one over here.
Yep.
Geez, there's so many things. Well, let's stay where we are for a second with the Homeland Security police state type thing going on here. I did misspeak earlier. I wanted to make the correction. This is not America. It's the homeland. Okay, it always was. DHS turns over Occupy Wall Street documents to Truth Out by Jason Leopold from Tuesday. It's truthout.org there. Man, as though we didn't all see this coming. For, 15 years or something. I'm surprised it's taken them so long, actually. But it's kind of a fun way to see the practice introduced into American society, into state practice as Occupy arrestees arraigned. That is, these are people who are not criminals, right? These are people who are the protesters who refuse to leave when they're told to leave, right? American speechers.
Arrested for it.
Mm-hmm. As Occupy arrestees arraigned, iris scans affect bail. Huh. Someone was teaching a little bit of economic theory to the pigs down at the courthouse. They figured out, huh, there's such a thing as an economic incentive for something. Huh.
Time preference.
That's the first time anybody at the courthouse had ever thought along these lines before. But, so they said, hey, if you want to pay less to get out of jail, get your iris scan. Actually, it was the other way around. It was, oh, you don't want to get your iris scan? Well, we're raising your bail. Your Honor, we want to raise the bail to even higher. And the judge goes along with that. And they say in this article, it's the Village Voice, a blog at the Village Voice, as Occupy arrestees arraigned, iris scans affect bail. And it's the judges making up the law as they go along. Who's going to tell them they can't? The judges? Oh, wait. They're the judges. They're the final decision makers in their own conflicts. And if they decide against you, that's about the end of that. What a creepy eyeball picture on this article, man. It's
whose eyeball is that?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is that like David Bowie's light-colored eye or something?
I don't know. It's it could be. Anyway, so yeah, it's on now. You understand? Soon. Very soon. And you know, the older you get, the faster time goes by.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Very soon, all deputy sheriffs and city police and state police troopers and National Guardsmen and everybody else will have a little iris scanner hooked on their belt. And you will put your eyeball in the eyeball scanner. Turns out you were born with the beast mark all along.
They didn't. I never thought about it that way.
You didn't have to go sit down and get your tattoo at all. Not
sure.
Your
iris is pretty close to your forehead.
There you go. You had it all along. All they got to do is run a little algorithm through, and the shape of your looky hole,
which is unique
is
to you.
Yeah.
Which proves that you're an individual, by the way. Not to get off on that tangent.
Right. But it also. It's like the little electronic chip that you put in your dog. It's the proof that you belong to the state. How do you like that? Blogs at the Village Voice. The Occupy protesters. And you know what? Let's pretend for a minute that these were dangerous revolutionary communists as existed in mythology in America, you know, like even at the heyday of the Communist Party in the
bomb
20s,
throwers.
That they could have, or teens or 20s, that they could have ever overthrown the government at all in this country. Give us a break. But anyway, just pretend that they were that bad. You know, unleash the federal police on them, huh? You know, there's that new love story movie out about J. Edgar Hoover.
Yeah, I didn't see it. I'm not gonna.
It's, nah, you should watch it. It's good.
I heard it's long. Long movies intimidate me.
It's long. I liked it.
Okay,
it's
well.
It's got a lot of abusive power in it, you know, that kind of thing. But boy, he had to fight so hard. And this is an important lesson for people, I think. He had to fight so hard just for the FBI agents to be able to carry guns. He had to, like, buy his own guns. And then round up all the local cops to do all his SWAT raids for him. And then he would give them guns. There's no rule against that. Like, he had to buy them on his own and whatever. And Congress wasn't happy about it, and Congress didn't want to change. And then, of course, you know, hopefully people somewhat know the history that they used the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby as the linchpin, where the New Jersey State Police just aren't up to it, and we're going to have to intervene here. And, of course, they didn't succeed in solving the crime anyway. I guess they were thwarted from participating. But anyway, it was after that that the interstate, whatever the hell clause in the Constitution means that J. Edgar Hoover can do whatever he wants. But it was really difficult for them to get that power. And even at the heyday of, you know, massive strikes and whatever, you know, Red Scare tactics of reactionaries in D.C., who probably had, you know, a point. But anyway, you know, they could deport some people and whatever. I don't know. I guess maybe the fact that there weren't many laws about it meant they could get away with more in a way. But the idea that you would just have outright, without any kind of cringing, without any embarrassment, about, without any real recognition that, boy, have times really changed around here, huh? You just have this national police force that helps coordinate all the state and I mean, it's not quite there yet all the way, but isn't it? I don't know.
Up and coming.
If you took somebody like, I don't know, Garrett Garrett from like the 40s, and you asked him, all right, well, how would you describe this? It would be pretty much, hey, this is the Gestapo. What are you doing? You know, why do you have this? Homeland, Department of Homeland Security. Did it not occur to you? How is it that we got all the way to 2002 without one of these damn things? And then all of a sudden it was okay to have one? Maybe it hadn't been okay to have a national police force really before that. In fact, you can even find quotes of J. Edgar Hoover talking about, oh, the FBI is no national police force. Hell no. And if it ever was, then that would be like the Germans, and that would be horrible. You know, that kind of thing. But, oh, yeah, well, everything did change on 9/11 after all, I guess. Anyway, some people don't even notice it's dangerous. What do you know about that? All right, Zoe, I told you earlier, and mm-hmm. I wasn't lying. At least it's still the plan. I guess I could still be proven wrong. Dinah Razor is going to be on the show. Maybe. Dina Rasor?
I will ask.
I don't know. Please ask her for me. From Truthout, where Jason Leopold writes. She's going to be on the show to talk about Lockheed. I'm going to try very hard to not interrupt her very much. Let her really teach us a lot of cool stuff about how horrible they are. Okay, now, it's Friday, so that means a little bit of mopping up exercises from earlier in the week, and then, of course, plus new news breaking that's important. I should probably let you look at your list if you want to get a start off with what you want to catch up on here, Zoe.
Oh, yeah, well...
Because otherwise, I'm just going to pick up the skateboard and skate with it.
Where to begin? I guess, as I always wonder, what the heck is going on in Syria? Does anyone... There's nobody on the ground. There's nobody reporting, I don't think, is there? They can't. It's too unsafe.
Well, no. I don't know if he's still there, but Nir Rosen was there. And, you know, he had... I failed to read enough of it. But he was saying that, yeah, you know... there's a lot of indigenous insurgency here. No, it ain't all peaceful protesters, but that doesn't all mean that they're sock puppets of the Americans either. And then a few days after that, they said, yeah, Giraldi was right in the beginning of December that America has been backing the rebels since then, at least. It's not Dr. Pepper. All right. Welcome back, everybody. So, it's the show. Pardon me, I had to stop and drink some Dr. Pepper. It's hot in here. I should be sponsored by Dr. Pepper, man, for all the sponsoring of them I've done over the years. All right. So, lots of important stuff to talk about. You brought up Syria, and then the music started playing. So, let's talk about Syria. There are people in Syria, maybe a majority of people in Syria, who would like to see the dictatorship go. There are a number of people, I don't know what kind of plurality or what, who have participated in protests, some of them massive protests, including in the big cities and whatever. And then you have, of course, a smaller proportion of people who, as I was saying, Nir Rosen describes as very much just grassroots neighborhood militia folk who are rising up that this is their chance to overthrow Assad. And, of course, he shoots at them, so they shoot back and whatever. Then, of course, he also says that, you know, every time that they say this many people killed, a lot of times that's the fighters. It's a battle going on. It's not quite a civil war, I don't think, because the rebels aren't anywhere near as powerful as the government of Syria. Okay, so then, you know, it's way oversimplified, and I don't even know if this is even fair at all to put it this way, but I think there's a kernel of truth in here anyway, which is there's a majority Sunni Arab population of that country, and it's ruled by the Alawite faction, which is like 10% of the society, which is an offshoot sect of Shiites. And then they are backed by a coalition of everybody else. And that's just old world politics. It's not much different here, unfortunately. You know, where it's just ethnic groups as voting blocks, as much as they have votes, you know what I mean? You know, figurative or literal ones. Their power must be balanced. And so all the other different sects, basically, and including, according to Pepe Escobar, the affluent business class Sunnis, they support the Alawite government, the Assad government. And so,
religious
and also
minorities.
The Russians do. Okay, so there's all that. Then there's the fact that the U.S., NATO, which is the U.S., and its puppet satellite states like France and Germany and Britain.
And, yeah, England.
Airstrip 1
yeah.
over there, America's forward operating airbase, that they want regime change there. And I really don't know why, other than, there's the obvious reason. What I mean is, I don't know of any other reason that I can really think of other than because that's what Benjamin Netanyahu wants. And then I can't figure out if, and you know what, there must be enough good journalism on this already that I should really know better. Is this what Benjamin Netanyahu really wants? Regime change and maybe a years-long Iraq-style civil war in Syria? I mean, you could see how from one point of view, well, at least that means that they'll be busy killing each other and not mess with us or whatever. But you know what? The Syrians aren't messing with Israel anyway. I mean, I guess they do support Hezbollah, but Hezbollah isn't messing with Israel anyway. Hezbollah's a threat in the sense that they can resist invasion. just like Iran is a threat to the United States, you know? Now what, you know, all the stories is that, you know, there's covert action going on that I guess special forces and CIA are trying to support these guys with money, with aid, with probably lots of weapons. But then what, a few weeks ago, I'm sorry, I should be a lot better on this, but what, two and a half, three weeks ago, there was a pretty big, push by the government into the city of Homs, where they retook the town, basically, from the insurgency. Now, I don't really know how much of that is, you know, the same thing as America rolling into Kandahar and claiming that they took the town, when, you know, really they've done no such thing or what exactly, but certainly seen that with or without American backing, the rebels there aren't doing very well. And, of course, Philip Giraldi, former CIA officer and DIA officer and writer for the American Conservative and antiwar.com, wrote in December, early December of, you know, the end of 2011 there, that there were two new findings and that America had stepped up covert support inside Iran, covert action inside Iran, and covert action in Syria as well then. So now they gave some indication that they were thinking twice about it. I still can't get over her. I'll keep bringing up anyway Hillary Clinton sort of musing out loud. I don't know if this was deliberate or, you know, this is part of her script for the day that she meant to do, or she was just sort of thinking out loud and not thinking of maybe the consequences of saying this kind of thing. But she said, you know, Hamas and Al-Qaeda have already publicly come out on the side of the rebellion. And so, maybe we ought to think twice about the hell we're doing here.
Do we really want to back al-Zawahiri on this
one? Yeah. I'm going, well, wait a minute now, you know, goofing around over here at Anti-War Radio. We were already thinking about that, you know? Welcome to thinking about the next step of what might occur, you know?
It's called multi-step thinking, Mrs. Clinton.
No, just two. Just the next step.
Two is more than one.
Yeah, we need you to sit still, Hillary, for just a minute and think. Are you sure you want to do this? Maybe not. And you know what? The police state there is horrible, and I'm not on the side of the state in Syria. I'm just against the side of American intervention in this thing. Let the people of that country work it out the best that they can for themselves. And it sucks to be them, man. Look, it's a luck of the draw thing, as best as I can tell. You know, where you happen to be born, where you get to grow up. I get to be from Texas, which makes me about, you know, luckier than anybody, right? But everybody else, they're screwed. It's not, you know, but that doesn't mean it's every Texan's responsibility to save them from being a Syrian. Just sucks to be Syrian, that's all. Although I'm totally for open immigration and whatever, so the hell, man, get on a boat and come on over to Texas and we'll all skate or barbecue or whatever it is.
Play some guitar.
Everybody likes barbecue.
Most people like guitar.
Oh. Yeah, I mean, even Indians will have chicken and ribs and stuff.
Sure. They do tandoori barbecue, which is in those clay ovens. It's really good. It's delicious.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never had Indian food that was delicious before. But anyway. All right. I'll stop insulting everybody's culture and tradition now. Forget what you love. It's horrible. So there was this piece. We're talking about Syria. There's this piece, and I got to find it because I don't know what the hell I did with it, Zoe. It's over here somewhere. Damn it. EnglishAlAkbar.com. U.S. mercenary took part in Gaddafi killing, sent to assist Syrian opposition. And this is just about outsourcing covert action in Libya and in Syria. And that is what's going on here in Syria, is the Libya model, more or less.
Even
slow
though it doesn't
motion
fit.
Regime change.
Even though it doesn't fit at all, it's a square peg in a round hole.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I got Zoe Greif here. And I was telling you yesterday, my buddy George said in an email, hey, man, you're right. Maybe they really should run Ron Paul as this most unique political character in all of American history. World history, perhaps. And just show him saying great stuff. Yeah? And then instead of running him as a run-of-the-mill Republican and trying to get Republicans to think that he's the most Republican guy of all, when obviously the party doesn't think so, that's never going to fly. Why not run him as the guy that everybody loves so much? Huh?
Show some reaction shots of people saying from their bottom of their heart, how much I love this guy, he cured my apathy, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. So, what I said yesterday on the show was, yes, George, of course you're right, that I'm right. That's right. But then he also said, hey, man, so I'm going to give a speech at my local caucus primary, something or other, where I could maybe help get some votes for him in my local district precinct, whatever it's called. Do you have any ideas for a speech? So I was sitting here playing the recording of the James Bamford interview that I'd recorded the day before on the show yesterday, and I hammered out this little speech, and then I forgot about it. And then this morning I fixed a couple of little typos and changed a couple of little things. I'll probably notice some more. And I sent it off. But it's supposed to be short and sweet. This may be too long. I don't know. Timey.
Okay.
Ron Paul is a man of proven character. Just take one look at his huge family, 52-year marriage, his professional career as a doctor, not a lawyer, the thousands of clips of his speeches and interviews on YouTube. His honesty and integrity consistently shine through. You can see it in the way he runs his office at the Capitol. He's the only congressman who's always refused to take part in Congress's expensive medical benefits and pension package, and he's the only one who always returns thousands of dollars from his office budget at the end of the year. And you can see it in the perfect consistency of his voting record, unmatched by anyone, certainly anywhere near this race. Ron Paul has also proven unparalleled foresight on the economy. As a doctor, he ran a successful small business, and he's also an economist, one who, unlike the rest of New York, D.C., and the media, correctly predicted and warned against the creation of the dot-com, housing, and stock market bubbles. Governor Romney may be a businessman, but as an economist, has recommended Obama's same bailout policy. No other candidate is calling for real spending cuts at all. Dr. Paul wants $1 trillion in cuts his very first year. We know he means it. And don't believe the hype. Ron Paul is strong on defense, but he insists, as many of us do, that we do not need to occupy the world in order to defend this country. And the national debt is $16 trillion. We just can't afford it. For years they called Paul Dr. No for standing alone against the consensus in Congress. Now it's clear he was right and the consensus was wrong. We can have a free and prosperous economy. We can have peace. We can keep our liberty and be secure too. Please vote Ron Paul.
That was about 80, just under 90 seconds.
Really?
Just under a minute and a half.
So there you go, George. Read him that really fast. I try to read it fast. A minute and a half. I think that's what he says he had, right? A minute and a half? Was it a minute or two or something?
Yeah, yeah. If you pace...
Oh, no. 30 to 60 seconds. You're going to have to lose a paragraph there.
Or take your auctioneer speed read voice.
But that's pretty good, though, huh?
Yeah, I like it.
That's what I think. I mean, you know, that's... For new people.
101 type.
Yeah, man.
Meet Ron
Welcome
Paul.
Welcome to who this guy is, you know.
The Ron Paul guide, not for idiots, but for people who don't know
him.
There
should be a line in there about, why does everybody love this guy so much? Maybe they read some of his articles. You know? That's what it means to me, right? I remember reading in 1998 or something, and he was great on Iraq and everything back then. God, he's so good on it all. But I remember reading way back then, A Republic, If You Can Keep It, which is just a speech he gave on the House floor, you know. And then he followed that up like a couple of months later with, sorry, Mr. Franklin, we're all Democrats now. And it was how everybody's just a New Dealer around here, basically. The New Deal consensus still prevails, and we've gone way off our target from a limited constitutional government with a real rule of law that binds the power of the people in power, etc. And when I read that, I thought, wow, can you imagine a congressman writing this stuff this way and saying these things and being this anti-war and this good on economics and this good on every part of every amendment in the Bill of Rights? Wowee, man. That's the whole thing about Ron Paul is you don't ever see, look, I mean, go back in time, think every Democrat that lost or won for anything or anything. You know, Bill Clinton could wow people over by shaking their hand real warmly and going, oh, I like you or whatever. But did anybody ever go, wow, he's just brilliant. And what his vision or whatever for the way things ought to be is great. Did anybody ever think that about him? Or just, I like Bill. I like George Bush. I drink a beer with George Bush. That Al Gore, he's a big wimp. But George Bush, he seems like a close enough poser, tough guy to me. I guess we'll go ahead and go with that. I heard he's from Connecticut, but anyway.
Heard he's afraid of horses, but so what?
But here, Ron Paul, and Ron Paul does have, you know, a remarkable character, and that's part of why everybody likes him so much, is because not only is he such a great libertarian on all the issues, but... he makes a great spokesman because nobody's got anything on him. He's just a decent old guy. Nice old country doctor. Take good care of you, you know? Always was. And was right about the economy when everybody else was an idiot. And the proof of that is that I was right about it. And I told you, and anti-war's been my focus, but anybody's listened to the show for years and years and years can tell you. I've been warning all about the housing bubble, at least from time to time. Warning about the distortions in the market and how they did it in with the dot-com bubble and how there's inflation in the fuel prices and in housing and in foodstuffs and whatever all along. I had Ron Paul on mostly to talk about foreign policy, but he would always say, yeah, it's starting to come to an end over here, this bubble. And the thing is, the reason I knew about it was just because I was listening to him. Long before I ever had him on the show, back in the year 2000, he was saying, okay, now that your stock market bubble is gone, I urge you to rethink your policy of just reinflating another bubble, and this time in housing. You're just going to hurt everybody once it all falls apart. So let's have real economics starting right now. You know, that was what he was saying 12 years ago. And they didn't listen to him, of course, but I was listening to him. I told you I even had an anecdote, and this is how I know the timing on it, whatever, is because I asked them when they bought their house. Some friends of mine, I told them, no, don't buy a house now. It's a big bubble. You should wait until the bubble pops and the prices fall, but before they raise the interest rates from all the inflation from the new bubble, that's when you buy your house, which is actually right now. So run out and get one as they're inflating.
Already got one.
Yeah, if you have any credit or whatever. I don't. Yeah, I sure as hell don't. Anyway. I said, when did you guys buy your house? I just asked them the other day. It was the year 2000. And how did I know this? Because I was listening to Ron Paul. I never read all the great Austrian economics textbooks, and I sure should have, and I mean to one day, I swear. You know? Good thing I know Bob Murphy. It kind of set me straight about stuff, but... that's how I knew about it's a big housing bubble, and you don't want to participate in that, you know, and get yourself caught up owing more than your house is worth. You know what I mean? How the hell did my dumb cab driver ass know about that in the year 2000? Ron Paul was talking. I was listening to him then. Yeah. And before, and during that, during this dot-com hype of 1997, 8, 9, and into 2000 until it finally finished all falling apart. He called it all then, too. Man, he ought to win some states. I mean, it's not over yet. Some states ought to rally to his cause. Of course, Republicans love a winner, and he looks like he's behind. And, of course, I guess, you know, Santorum, because they know Ron Paul's not going to drop out, so Santorum and Gingrich have to stay there as the Ron Paul blockers. My friend Phil, you know, it's been since, I guess, sixth grade was last time I watched Hulk Hogan and all that. But my buddy Phil is a big wrestling fan, and he's explaining who's playing what role in this political wrestling match about how, yes, I've learned a lot under his tutelage about... the jobbers, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, just trying... Everybody knows it's Romney's the one. This ain't a free country. Give me a break. But they just don't want Ron Paul to have that much access to the argument. So they got to drown him out with these nobodies. These empty sweater vests. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And we owe some serious thanks to some very high-level pigs. And I don't know who they are, if it's Obama's guys, if it's on his word. I think, I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to tell by how they describe their anonymous sources. Maybe it's mid-level CIA or high-level CIA analysts or military intelligence people. I'm not exactly sure. But it keeps coming out now. Twice, James Risen in the New York Times, now brand new one in Reuters, that actually the Iranians do not have a nuclear bomb. They have not decided to build one, and they're years away from having a deliverable nuclear warhead. That's if they started building one. In other words, Scott Horton's crying and complaining for days on end, every day, for years on end. That if you actually read the IAEA report, you'll see that all their uranium is accounted for. If you read the NIE from 2007, and if you read the journalism about the NIE from 2010-11, then you will see that that's what the combined unanimous assessment of the American intelligence community is, that they're actually not making nukes. We've known this all along. Mark Hosenball wrote this in 2010. Seymour Hersh came out with an article almost a year ago, May of 2011, called Iran and the Bomb, that talked all about what the Joint Special Operations Command knows. That's Seymour Hersh. He's got sources. What they know and how they know it. And so, good. I don't know exactly who's all behind this, but what it amounts to is... Hopefully. I don't know if TV will pick up on this or what. I don't watch the nightly news. I guess I should. I don't know if anybody watches it anymore. Maybe it doesn't matter what they say on the nightly news anymore.
It's pretty disgusting, Scott.
Watch the Lair News Hour or something. But this is, I mean, you think about where we were 10 years ago with the Cheneyites saying the policies regime change and we're coming up with WMD lies. If you're an exile and you've got some BS to peddle, come on in, we'll pay you. Uh, there was some pushback. Of course, Jonathan Landay and War and Peace Strobel at Knight Ridder Newspapers, they talked to some mid-level CIA guys who pushed back on some of this, but they were just completely overwhelmed. But in this case, it looks like the president is basically taking the Rand Paul position that maybe if he does sanctions, he can do just sanctions and not war, which is not a safe strategy, if that is in fact his strategy. Which makes Rand Paul exactly like Barack Obama, doesn't it? Anyway, this is a pretty high-level official debunking, I think. Turns out, guys, that after all, nope, they're really not making nukes. Nope, they're really not a nuclear threat to Israel, and certainly not to the United States. You know what this is, really? This is just the empire thrashing about and throwing a temper tantrum and acting out in anger and frustration like a little toddler because they screwed up. Because 10 years ago, they said, hey, if you're an Iraqi exile with some lies to peddle, come on in. We'll pay you. And what they did was they ended up giving the south of Iraq, including the capital city, to the best friends of the Iranians. The Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, whose people were the Iraqi traitors who fled to Iran during the Iran-Iraq War when America was on the side of Saddam and the MEK against the Iranians. These were the Iraqis who fought for the Iranians and fled to Iran. And we just fought an 8-year war to install them in power. They turned around and kicked us out. So now the empire's angry because they let Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld decide what to do, and those guys are idiots, man. Aside from being very mean-spirited and greedy and bloodthirsty. Mean-spirited, that was the favorite, like, slander smear term against someone in the 1990s. Remember that? That guy is so mean-spirited. Yeah, Dick Cheney, the blood-soaked monster with the razor claws. Cut that man until he accuses Jose Padilla of making dirty bombs. Good. And cut that man until he admits Saddam Hussein trained him how to make chemical weapons. You let somebody like that decide whether or not you ought to regime change Iraq, well, here's what you get. And it turned out, haha, the defectors, their ringleader, Ahmed Chalabi, who's now in charge of the office of excluding candidates he doesn't like from the ballot, on behalf of the Dawa Party. He was an Iranian agent. Yeah, his headquarters, tell me CIA didn't know this, his headquarters was in Tehran. And of course there was a big scandal when it came out that he told the Iranians that the Americans had broken all their codes. How did he know that? Probably Douglas Feith told him. But anyway, the DIA and the CIA did a damage report, and they came out and they said, you know what? And you can read all about this. You just type in Chalabi DIA CIA report, and you'll see it. Maybe add Iran to your search term. They think not only did he hook the Iranians up with, hey, here's what the Americans have on you, but that he was actually sent by the Ayatollah Khamenei to lie America into war with Iraq in the first place. Something on the order of, there's some pro-Israel neocons, pro-Lockheed neocons in this administration who really want to get Saddam. We should help them. So, Mr. Chalabi, gather your merry band of liars. Head to America and tell Richard Pearl that you'll build an oil and water pipeline to Haifa. Everything will be great. And that the new Iraq will be run by, I don't know, Hashemite King or whatever they need to hear. And will be Israel's best friend in the region from now on. Better even than Egypt. And so there you go. And you can read a great piece all about this, by the way, called How Chalabi Conned the Neocons. And I'm not sure, actually, if they really have about how he was an Iranian spy in that one so much as just, here are the lies he peddled to get the neocons to fall for this and agree to, you know, his plan, partly, anyway, enough to get the war going. But so, You know, and I think Noam Chomsky said it right on the show when he said that, you know, part of America's beef with Iran is the same part of their same thing that is their beef with Cuba. They don't care whether the people of Cuba live in communist slavery or not. Why would they? What they care about is the government of Cuba told them no and got away with it. Ooh, and they tried to kill him with an exploding cigar. It didn't work.
And the LSD and everything else.
Yeah. They tried to poison his scuba gear with nitrogen or whatever, and it didn't happen. So they're just mad. And the Iranians, they declared independence from the United States back in 1979, and that makes them a threat. They're not allowed to declare independence. And that's why they backed Saddam Hussein's eight-year invasion and war against them. Even though they were, in fact, backing the Iranians at the same time in the Iran-Contra arms for hostages thing. Through the Israelis, by the way. The Americans were saying, hey, Israel, sell Iran some missiles and we'll reimburse you. That's how dangerous. And that was in the days of the bad old Ayatollah, who was much meaner than the one they got now. Much more mean-spirited.
Oh, yeah.
Than the one they have now. But anyway, so that's what all this is really about, I think, is, they're mad that the Iranians have independence, and they're really mad that their big project to conquer Iraq turned out to be them, you know, falling for the easiest trick in the book. You know? Let's you and him fight. And the Ayatollah played it perfect. What, is he an idiot or something? And you know what? This is ties right back into the nuclear program because Seymour Hersh says that the conclusion of the American intelligence community is that the Iranians quit even looking into nukes, which I think all they're basing that on is the alleged studies forgeries in the first place. But anyway, they certainly gave all this up back in 2003. And why is that? Because that's not when America scared them into giving it up. That's when America took out the last threat that justified the pondering of atomic weapons, Saddam Hussein, Iran, the Iranian Revolution's mortal enemy. And so, geez, if we don't have to deter Saddam Hussein from invading our country again, we don't need nukes at all. Because what are we going to do from the point of view of the Iranian government? What are we going to do? All of a sudden, magically come up with 600 nukes and match the Israelis? Or 3,000? 50,000 and match the Americans? No, of course not. One nuke is enough to deter Saddam, who had none, and everybody knew it. But it made no sense for them to pursue a nuclear program once America did their dirty work for him. So that's why Hillary's mad. It's her war. All right, y'all, back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And I guess I have a couple of points to make, which everybody gets to, so I do too. About the shooting of this kid down in Florida, Trayvon Martin. Cops shoot unarmed black kids every day. And something makes me think that liberals in America are deep down such Bolsheviks in their hearts that they love the state so much they just can't bear to make this much of an issue out of somebody killed by a cop. But here comes a wannabe cop, a self-appointed private night watchman, acting like he's a cop when he's not really a cop, and kills somebody. And all of a sudden, you know, as though it was, you know, three words that Rush Limbaugh said or something, every liberal decides that this is the most important thing in the world to them. And I'm not trying to downplay this because I think it's wrong for people to murder people. You know, that's sort of the point of all this. But it just seems like, you know, what are the barriers of the subject have to be or not be in order for it to be discussable as a topic, you know, in order for it to be a big deal? If this had been a cop, why would this have been the biggest deal in the world? What makes it different than cops killing people all the time? And in your town, too. You don't need me to tell you, hell. You could be as wise as can be, and from as west as you can get, and still be within whatever city limits you're in. And you still know that, yeah, they kill unarmed black guys from time to time because that's their job. They're cops. That's what they do. Apparently, that's what they got hired to do. So, you know, I'm not trying to diminish the importance of this particular murder. I'm trying to minish the rest of them.
That probably is a word.
Can I do that? Can I say minish? I'm trying to minish the rest of these. I think that it's important that cops not be allowed to get away with murder. Sovereign immunity. Like they're Charles the First. And even Charles the First, he was beheaded. And they said, how immune are you now, dude, now that we cut your head off? That's funny, because you claim sovereign immunity, and yet it was just a metaphysical concept. It actually did not sword-proof your neck. So, anyway, why should any government employee have sovereign immunity? Why should they be able to avoid accountability? That's all I'm saying. I'm very happy that people are upset about this. Why not? Actually, I have no idea the facts of the case. You know, maybe he shouldn't have followed the kid, but maybe the kid turned around and slugged him a bunch of times, and then he stupidly pulled out his gun, and then he thought, oh no, he could take my gun from me. So, and he's still fighting me, so I better use it. In that case, maybe it's a shade of gray. Maybe he shouldn't have followed the kid, but then maybe, who knows? We don't know. Not that I would count on the state to have it all come out in their government courtroom about what the real truth is or anything. But, yeah, I mean, seems like the wannabe cop picked the fight. Which makes him a lot like Barack Obama, for example, who kills people all the time. And why is it that the very people who are all worked up, it's like they have this pent-up disgust about Obama's mass murder and torture and everything else. His expansion of AFRICOM, his brutal world empire and domestic police state. They want to take it all out on this one neighborhood watchman. You know, poor bastard. Because who's their real enemy? It's the president of the United States. The guy that goes around killing people all the time. Including making the unprecedented claim. In the entire history of America, I saw MJ Rosenberg slamming Andrew Jackson on Twitter earlier. Well, good. Andrew Jackson murdered people a lot. But he called them aliens first, you know? They were the Indians. They weren't American citizens. He never claimed the power to just have American citizens assassinated. I mean, whatever. Throw a coin in the air. It's extremely possible that he ordered people murdered all the time. But he never claimed that that was the official power of his office, to just order people murdered. You're confusing that for the pardon power, which is actually the power to let people off the hook unilaterally. It doesn't say you get to just put people on hooks. You are the hook putter. Doesn't say that in Article 2 at all. So Obama is quantifiably, in terms of executive power claimed, the worst ever. He's worse than Roosevelt. He has literally claimed no limit whatsoever on his authority. So, yeah, that's bad. So instead, let's just get real mad at the rent-a-cop. At the self-appointed rent-a-cop. Ooh, boy, don't you hate guys like that? Night watchman. Go inside and read a book, dude. Leave us alone. Right? So, come on, entire country, let's get him. You know? He could be the scapegoat for all of our frustrations about our hero, Barack Obama, whose regime of unremitting slaughter continues. Unabated. And without even any pretension of accountability, since his only opposition is a bunch of Mitt Romneys calling him a wimp every day. Oh, Barack Obama, he's in league with the Muslim juggernaut, the Islamo-fascist terrorist caliphate against us. He's like having a Trojan horse inside the country. Maybe he works for the KGB. He's not even from here. And you know, if he was a real American, he would have bombed Iran already. If it was a real American, we'd have troops on the ground everywhere. We would surge into Afghanistan double. Maybe Pakistan, too. Maybe drone strikes aren't enough for them, and in order to really fix their wagon, we need to get in there with the U.S. Army. That's the only criticisms that they can think of to attack Barack Obama with. That he doesn't kill people enough. So he has all the cover in the world to just kill people all day long. And there may be liberals in the audience who are in denial and trying to plug your ears and sing Mary Had a Little Lamb real loud so that you don't have to deal with the truth. But just go read Jeremy Scahill in The Nation about the secret torture dungeon beneath Mogadishu. It's not run by the natives. It's run by Barack Obama. By the Joint Special Operations Command and the CIA. His Joint Special Operations Command. His CIA. And, you know what? I've never been in the military or anything like that, but I've talked with a few people a few times, and I think Nick Turse was the most recent who really explained this. And that is that the Joint Special Operations Command is not under the Special Operations Command. The Joint Special Operations Command simply works for the president. They are outside of the Department of Defense. They are just the president's private army. And I heard rumors back in the 90s that these guys called Bill Clinton by his first name, kind of a thing. And in a derogatory way. They didn't call him Mr. President. They would say things like, look, Bill, here's what I can do for you, okay? Because when it really comes down to it, what's Bill Clinton without a private army of killers to do what he wants? And that's what the Joint Special Operations Command is, and that's what Barack Obama uses them for, to just kill people all the time. Raimondo is making the extremely important but obvious point in his article today that what is the massacre, the Bales massacre in Afghanistan, other than a night raid? So one guy did it off the clock. A night raid's a night raid. This could have actually been a night raid that kind of got out of control. And then one guy volunteered to take the rap for it or something, you know, possibly. But what's a night raid other than you kick in the door and you shoot people to death? And if the neighbors come outside, you shoot them to death. That's a night raid. And I'm not that old, man. I can still do a frontside rock and roll. And I remember when that was the epitome of the Gestapo and the NKVD. That was how the Nazis and the KGB guys did it. The Soviets did it. Come to your house in the middle of the night to take you away, if you're lucky. The night raid. Why, that's the backbone of our strategy, said Senator Lindsey Graham the other day. You can't halt those. Wow, so interesting new piece at Lou Rockwell's blog here by Daniel McAdams about Turkey's role in the attempted regime change in Syria. And this piece in a Lebanese paper about how the Turkish government is thinking, oh man, maybe we shouldn't have done this. This being, you know, let the so-called Free Syrian Army have a base on their soil. And working with U.S. and other special forces inside Syria. So now, as Dan McAdams puts it, Erdogan seems to think that all he can do now is double down on a bad bet. Now he's got to work for even harder for regime change inside Syria so that he didn't have to deal with Assad after failing to overthrow him. And then, so I wonder who's zooming who on all this. I guess if Qatar and Saudi Arabia are backing the rebels in Syria, then that just means they're America's sock puppets, right? And it's America having Saudi Arabia do it. It's like America had Saudi Arabia do it during the 1980s in Afghanistan against the Russians, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, I'm not denying, of course, the American involvement on the ground, obviously. But I'm just saying, apparently a lot of the weapons and money and men have come from Saudi Arabia. But what are they except satellites of the American Empire? I cannot imagine what in the world is going through the minds of the Americans pushing for this. Of the Obama, the president, and his National Security Council. This is what they think they're doing. And who do they think is next? I guess they figure at some point the maybe years worth of killing. At some point, it'll finally die down. And then they'll just try to back whoever, you know, rises to the top. And hope that from now on they can have Syria as a friendly client state. Does that sound like a brilliant plan to you guys? And of course, Jeffrey Goldberg and Barack Obama, they didn't mince any words in that interview whatsoever, did they? Jeffrey Goldberg says, yeah, don't you think regime change in Syria would have really hurt Iran? And Barack Obama says, yep, that's exactly what it's all about, baby. Oh, what? Care about the people of Syria? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did I forget to mention? In fact, he didn't even say that. Barack Obama did not even remember to say, oh, I mean that my heartstrings are tugged by the fate of the poor Syrian civilians. He didn't even remember to say that. It wasn't in the question. So he didn't have it to parrot back. Don't you think regime change in Syria would really help us put pressure on the Iranians? Damn right, responded the president. Go read it yourself. So yeah, please look at lourockwell.com/blog. Overeager to please allies, that is the U.S. and Israel, Turkey between a rock and a hard place. It's a good thing he writes there. That's what I think. All right. I said it yesterday, I'm going to say it again real quick, just so people are aware of this, in case you missed it. Some of the mercs that worked for Muammar Gaddafi's tyranny in Libya, after losing the war against the rebels, or maybe right before the loss, they took their guns and they went home to where they're from. They're the Tuaregs, whatever, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, I'm sorry to anyone descended of their ethnicity, I ain't trying to offend your delicate sensibilities. But anyway, they're this one tribe or whatever the hell of people over there. So, or some of them anyway. They leave Libya, they go home, they bring all their weapons with them, and they say, you know that rebellion that's sort of been stewing this whole time? Let's amp it up and let's see if we can, I don't know if they're trying to overthrow the government or mostly, more likely, just gain their independence. So they started attacking the government of Mali. Well, the government of Mali had been taken over in a military coup back in, I think, 91 or something. But the guy immediately took off his uniform and put on his civilian garb, and he stood for election two or three times since then. And was, you know, supposedly on his last term and was going to step down and try to turn this little Saharan country, West Saharan country, into democracy. Somewhat. And now, no, his military, tired of his ineffectual leadership, overthrew him yesterday so that they could wage their war against these newly armed rebels coming back from Libya as a result of America's war. So, congratulations for liberty. Oh, but don't worry. We gained a whole new democracy out of Libya, right, Scott? Isn't it true, though, that now they have an advanced parliamentary system and courts with a rule of law and... Right. No, just warring militias. And it won't be long before they have a problem getting food to market and from market. Their country falls apart. Okay, also I wanted to mention again the executive order thing.
Mm-hmm.
The executive order by Barack Obama, I am not downplaying the importance of it. I think I'm, you know, just trying to state accurately the importance of it. Your government has sort of a turnkey plan. Remember Bamford talked about the NSA's power, that this is a turnkey dictatorship. If they want to use everything the NSA has on us against us, or everything they can have on us against us. Well, this executive order that Barack Obama signed that's getting all this attention, which, I don't know, Google around, you'll find the damn thing. It doesn't have a number on it that I saw, which is interesting. Maybe just so it's harder to find. But anyway, this executive order, which is public, outlines an American fascist totalitarian dictatorship where the president has the power to conscript every soul, where he has the power to conscript every specialty, every doctor, every scientist, and every engineer, and seize every bit of property and every bit of transportation and distribution resources down to your Razor scooter. And, of course, including all fleet vehicles, all trucks and trains and whatever in the country. And it's pretty scary. It's like reading Philip Drew Administrator for, boy, you don't want your country to be like that. On the other hand, people are saying he must have just written this up because he plans on implementing it the day after tomorrow or something, or as soon as War with Iran breaks out, or as soon as this, that, or the other thing happens. And I think that is probably not the case, and the only reason I say that is because that's what I thought in the 1990s when Bill Clinton had the exact same executive order. It is a blueprint for a totalitarian state in America. And I'm not saying it's okay at all. I'm just saying you don't need to quit your job and head to the hills this week, necessarily. Not based on that. Anyway, that's basically all I'm getting at. Okay? That's all I'm trying to say. It was a 12919. And maybe if I have time, which I probably won't, I'd like to go through and compare the two. And I don't know what it was called under George Bush, Presidential Decision Directive something. But Bush had the same kind of thing. But so did Nixon and Ford and Carter and Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, too. So that's all I'm saying. Oh, good. We're going to learn all about Lockheed next. Sorry for all the important subjects I missed. Go to antiwar.com and read some stuff. You can learn a lot better that way anyway. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. And our next guest on the show today is Dina Razor. She is chief investigator of the Follow the Money Project and a partner in the Bauman and Razor Group. She has over 25 years of experience investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud. She trained as an investigative journalist and has worked for several media outlets such as ABC News and the San Francisco Examiner. For 10 years, she directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization that she founded, with its work with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and the defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. And then check out the books, More Bucks, Less Bang, How the Pentagon Buys Ineffective Weapons, back in 1983, The Pentagon Underground in 1985, and in 2007, Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. And she co-authored The Whistleblower's Manual, Courage Without Martyrdom, a survival guide for whistleblowers. Wow, welcome to the show, Ms. Razor. How are you?
Okay, fine. I should say this Follow the Money Project is not really very active right now. Right now, most of my time is being a full-time columnist and writer for truthout.org now.
Okay, right on. Well, that's the part I was just going to get to, was this great piece at truthout.org. Lockheed,
right.
The ultimate pay-to-play contractor, and also at issue in this interview, your last piece, F-35 fighter is latest in a long line of wasteful weapons failures. Both of these sort of read like they were written by Joseph Heller. That's a compliment, but it's just like Catch-22 the way this system works, the way generals buy weapons, huh?
Yeah, the height of cronyism in the government gets down to the military weapons. It's members of Congress are occasionally willing, when you have Health and Human Services chair or somebody come up, the secretary, undersecretary or something, they see them as bureaucrats and they beat them up if they don't like what they see. But with the military stuff, it's just considered unseemly to beat up on a general. And so these they have an inoculation of between that and being able to hitch themselves up to the troops. Well, we're just doing this for the best of the troops. Meanwhile, they are probably some of the biggest self-dealing people who make sure they set up their post-retirement with a contractor. And
right.
It doesn't have to necessarily be say you were overseeing the F-35 at Lockheed. It wouldn't necessarily mean you'd go work for Lockheed, although a lot of them do, but other contractors then see that you're part of the game and you play part of the game, so they kind of swap who hires what general.
That's interesting. It really is that clear, huh? That which comes first, the lack of accountability and then the unlimited budget and the unlimited corruption. The lack of accountability breeds this kind
right.
of thing.
Well, it's gotten really, really bad in the last 10 years. I've noticed that, having gone after military stuff for 30 years, it used to be that cronyism, self-dealing, revolving door was the kind of stuff you did sort of in a hush-hush way. You did it, but you didn't advertise it, and everybody knew you were doing it, and, you know, the liberals would scream but go along with it as long as some members of Congress had defense stuff in their districts. But now it's considered completely cool. It's considered, no big deal. Everybody does it, you know, the cronyism mm-hmm. part, especially in the military. What people don't realize is that, you know, some of the generals that retired in after World War II, many of them saw that it was considered, it wasn't illegal, but it was considered distasteful or dishonorable if you would even think of going to work for a defense contractor after the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a creepy thing to do. And so a lot of the famous generals went to, you know, head a Red Cross, Marshall with the Marshall Plan, things like that. And I forget which general it was, but one of them, it may have been Bradley, went to work as the head of Rolex watches. You know, they would go to different places that were non-military. Mm-hmm. But that's completely gone now. It's very hard to find.
Yeah, you know, I don't even ever hear, sometimes in private economic circles, but never in government circles do I even hear the phrase conflict of interest anymore. That's sort of it has this echo in my brain, like the last time I heard it was in 1986 or something.
Yeah, well, it's a situation of cronyism. You know, it happened. The Clintons did it, but they were a little embarrassed that they did it. But the Bush people saw it as part of the capitalist system. They had no respect for the government, so what they could not kill, they would loot, or have their friends be in charge of, and that's how you ended up with, you know, people who didn't know how to run FEMA or other places, and then they say, see, government doesn't work because we put our cronies in there. They contracted out to their cronies, and then things would fall apart, and then they'd say, see, government doesn't work. So it's made it, the outrage is, I'm writing column on this every week now, and I'm finding from a lot of the readers is they just expect it, which is a really sad state of affairs. And they just expect that's what people are going to do. And
well, it has certainly been a long time now. Well, now, here's the thing, Dina. When I read that lengthy bio, I realized by the end of it that I really fell short, because the best part of your bio is the paragraph where you explain in this Lockheed article, The Ultimate Pay-to-Play Contractor at truthout.org, you say, I've been doing hand-to-hand combat with these guys on a sort of first-person basis since way back, and you give the litany of all the different times that you've come into direct conflict with these people, and that to me is very interesting. I think will help set up the rest of the conversation too, you know?
Yeah, it is true, and I kind of sit there, and when I was doing that, I didn't list all of them, but when I was doing that, I thought, yeah, you know, I've really had most of my headbutts has been with Lockheed, and I've been doing this for 30 years, and now they're the largest and most powerful company. So, yeah, I've really been doing my job.
Well, you know, you do what you can. It doesn't mean it's your fault when it doesn't work out the way you wanted it to.
Yeah, well, I could do nothing less. They really, really, really hated me back when I exposed their lobby plan and made
that. That's badge of honor enough right there, I think.
Yeah.
But no, tell us, though. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to...
Oh, tell us about that. Well,
yeah.
What would happen is, you know, you have to understand that when I was doing that, I was really young. And when I started the Project on Military Procurement, which is now POGO, which is a really well-known watchdog group, I was 25. And, you know, I took on a lot of different concepts, C5B and a lot of other things with Lockheed, and did a lot of headbutting with them. And at first they kind of ignored me, but then when it started to bite, they really started finding ways to try to harass me and whatever. I was never afraid of them because I'm a public figure. I was always afraid for my whistleblowers who weren't public figures at the time. But probably the worst thing they did to me, which quite frankly I've never talked about publicly but still burns me, I had a woman who came to me who told me I had a whole network of people in Lockheed Missile and Space on time card fraud, and they wanted to know who these people were. But I had a woman who came to me who worked from there, and she had filed a lawsuit, and she had talked to me, and she knew that I warned her that by talking to me, I would have to, that I could be deposed on what she told me because she'd already gone public. And they then decided to have they wanted to depose me, but not instead of just asking about what she knew, they said, we're going to depose you and we're going to get all your sources. And, then you'll have to name your sources. And I said, no, I don't, because I'm a nonprofit organization, blah, 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 blah. But I had to get a lawyer pro bono, and I was pregnant at the time. And I told him, you know, I'm not in the position to sit through a deposition. I'm at the end of my pregnancy, and I don't have a lawyer. So we kept going around and around. And I had my son, and after 4 weeks, we suddenly found out that my son had a heart defect, and he had to have open heart surgery. And so I just told my office, I'm gone. Just pretend I don't exist for a month because I can't do anything. And I was in the recovery room, literally, from my son's surgery, and I got this call. Hello?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the dang bumper music coming in here.
Oh, okay.
You know what? Well, here, I'm just going to dump it down. Let's just keep talking. This is ridiculous.
Okay,
I'm
well,
sorry.
Anyway, so what happened was... I got an emergency call, and I got called out thinking something had happened to my parents or something, and it was the hired lawyer for Lockheed, and he said, you're going to do this deposition, and I said, I can't. My son's had heart surgery. I can't do anything right now, and he said, okay, we're going to court. We're going to put a lien on it. We're going to take your car. We're going to take your house. We're going to completely destroy you, and I said, I don't care right now. I can't talk to you. My son's just had heart surgery. He says, I don't care. We're going to get you. We're going to get you. We're going to get you. And, you know, at that point, for the first time in my life, it became personal, and I began to realize what whistleblowers must feel. I was so mad. So eventually, I did have to be deposed by this guy and sit 7 hours across from him when I went to smack him in the face, and they threatened to put me in jail. And my lawyer had to run up to the appeals court to try to keep me out of jail while we were there, and I was all ready to go to jail. We had taken the house out of my name, and so that they... Judge couldn't put a lien on the house because it's only in my husband's name. I mean, this is serious stuff. And it was all a bluff. Lockheed made me spend a lot of time, money, and effort. Luckily, I did get a pro bono lawyer. But, you know, maybe 6 months of heartbreak of them going after me. And then at the end, in the parking lot, they said, well, we're not going to go up there. We're not going to do anything. And it was just completely and totally try to destroy me. And didn't do anything to me. I didn't have to name my sources. But, boy, after that, it became a little more personal.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like they could now give a seminar, one of those nifty little PowerPoints that they like, to the generals about blowback and what happens when you mess with somebody like this. Might just come back to haunt you here. Now you've been writing about them for 20 years since then, huh?
Yeah, well, and also I worked on big whistleblower suits, and I've never gotten the amount of money out of them I'd like to get out of them, but... they are, and the ironic thing about all this is that as they are the most celebrated, the most protected, and everything else, they're also the number one on the POGO's contractor misconduct.
Oh, you know what? I had misunderstood that in your article because I was surprised to see that anyone in the government was ranking them on their misconduct. Oh, I get it. It was an outside group.
Yeah, Project on Government Oversight.
There is no accountability whatsoever inside the government for Lockheed.
No,
still
no,
stands
no. Well,
then.
The government does put out, you know, yeah, the government.
The GAO
does put,
sometimes, right?
Well, no, but the government does put out things that say you're, you know, that you're barred or disbanded or, you know, you get these reprimands, but they don't put it all in one place. And the Project on Government Oversight, POGO, is the organization I founded that morphed into POGO. They have a contractor database, and Obama is trying to put together a contractor database, but the bureaucracy is fighting him like crazy. So POGO has it, and out of all the contractors, it's not just defense contractors, they're number one for misconduct, you know, a formal misconduct things like, you know, getting in trouble with different contracts and whatever in the whole government, not just in the DOD.
Well, and no surprise, too, since they're just the biggest overall anyway, right? They're how many times bigger than SIAC or the next biggest?
Yeah. Well, they're big, and they're big and more and influential. And in the article, I talk about that. I went back to the Sunlight Foundation databases. And you know, they've over since 89 they've spent $23 million on campaigns.
Well, you know, I was I was really astounded by that it only cost $23 million to buy $23 billion worth of influence, huh?
Yeah.
Maybe $230 billion.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't. That's why they're willing to invest that. They used to be able to write off, hire lawyers to defend them against the government, against their being investigated for wrongdoing, and then charge that onto the government. And one of the things we did get through is to stop defense companies from being able to charge their lawyer fees on trying to escape government oversight. So there's a little bit. This is kind of crazy, but. Like I said, they're like a privileged class, and that's one of the problems. It's much harder to get to them than any other government agency because they come in with their you know, the generals try to say we're the same as the troops, and they come in and they've got all their ribbons and honor and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And
people are really impressed by those ribbons, aren't they? They just love ribbons.
And I have found too, though, a lot of it is they kind of lose their. People kind of lose their awe in the military, lose their awe, and really what it's come down to is that if you make it past colonel, you've pretty much had to sort of sell out. There's a couple of good guys who generals and stuff, but there's an awful lot that's not. And that's been a big problem, that a lot of the good, true warriors, the good guys, and guys that you want to have who care about the troops and hold the contractor's feet to the fire, they usually get out at lieutenant colonel or colonel. They can't make it pass, so the decision makers are the ones that are the suck ups.
Mm-hmm. All right, now in this article, again, everybody, it's Dina Razor from truthout.org, Lockheed, the ultimate pay to play contractor. You talk about this recent article for defense.aol.com, and I didn't even know there was AOL.com anymore, but apparently they have this defense website where this guy wrote this article. I guess I'll ask you to tell us who he is and describe his article in detail, but basically his point is the future's looking really good for those who receive their dividend checks from Lockheed.
Yeah, well, he kind of stepped in it, and that's what made it so easy for me to write. His name's Lauren Thompson. And he has, you know, they have this Lexington Institute, in which was started by a former congressman, and it, you know, Lexington Freedom, you know, it's the whole part of that. And they get money from defense contractors for this. It's kind of like a heritage and everything else, only but for defense. And he writes positively about the defense industry, but he also consults for the defense industry, and he's saying some people who have conspiracy theories think this might be because, you know, they are doing pay to play, but it's really because, you know, they're number one because of their great management skills and stuff. Well, they're number one on the misconduct contractor thing. The F-35 is an unmitigated disaster and will continue to be, and is going to be one of the most expensive weapons in history, and yet it's having more problems than even their other problem plague things. And so, as a result, I just couldn't let his challenge go on. That he's funny. He even acts like, well, this is what people think, and he keeps saying it over and over. So I think he probably knows it's true, but he's always like, but they have such superior management, and they were cutting costs and all that. Cutting costs? Really? Well, the government sure like to know about that, because they're overrunning everything in a massive way, and the life cycle costs for this F-35 are going to be over $1 trillion. And I remember the day that they told the Armed Services Committee that, and even John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who never saw weapons and they didn't like, they kind of, although McCain, even though he wants to go to war, he can be tough on contractors. But they did. There was sort of a collective senator suck up. You know, the wind going, ooh, they couldn't believe $1 trillion.
Yeah, boy, those guys can suck too. But wait, you know what? I actually thought this must be a typo. I was going to quote this in the article and ask you about it, and then I thought, no, that just must not be right. So we'll not get bogged down there. But no, you're saying $672 billion. Isn't that as much as all the planes that the Air Force ever flew, or something?
Well, it's not that much that way, but yeah, it's the classic more bucks, less bang. It's doing the F-35 has become the epitome of what's been growing on this exponentially on every plane, and that is each plane gets priced on the cost of the older plane, and the older plane has all this fat, fraud, and waste in it. But what they end up doing is, it just multiplies up, and so they are now pricing themselves out of this plane, and on the meantime, they are doing what they call concurrency, and that's the developing the plane and putting it on the production line before all the bugs are worked out. And as a result, then, we're having to spend a whole lot of money going back and fixing it, and the government's doing most of that. Mm-hmm. So it's problem plagued, which is the less bang. You got a plane that doesn't work like it's supposed to, and then, of course, on top of it, it's costing more and more and more, so you're buying less and less and less.
Right. Well, that was what reminded me of Joseph Heller so much, was mm-hmm. when it comes to the problems with these things, it's always, I think you say there are no nanoseconds at all or something between. It's too early to tell, and it's too late to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's engineered that way. They don't ever want to have this opening, which is what happened with the F-22, much, to ever surprise that Gates actually found a moment where he could do it. But it's the classic thing is they keep saying, well, we don't know, and then, oops, well, we've already put in so much money, we can't change it. Too big to fail kind of thing,
Well, now, how bad of a lemon is the F-35, really? Because, like, for example, have they ever flown it in their little Top Gun games versus the F-15s?
No, they've just barely flown it. It just keeps perpetually having things go wrong, fuel problems and weight and engine, and it's just a myriad. Every time they come out with the testing comes out, it's just a big bunch of problems, which then they go back and say they're going to have to fix. And part of that problem is that you can't imagine that Ford Motor Company would take a prototype and say, okay, let's put this prototype on the production line and start making it. Meanwhile, we'll finish, doing the tweaks on it that actually makes it work and really on the road. And then we can have them sooner. Well, the problem is that when you don't work out the bugs before you go into expensive production, then you have to go back and fix it, and it costs a lot more to fix.
Yeah.
So this is what they're doing this is what they do with weapon systems because it takes them so long to get them through the system. There's all this fighting back and forth, and it's just incredibly dysfunctional.
So, in other words, though, there's no reason to believe at this point. They haven't demonstrated that these are or even could be superior to the F-15s and F-16s and F-14s that we already have.
By no means, yeah. I mean, those planes already had their problems, but it's so bad that they're starting to pour money back into the F-16s, which, by the way, Lockheed made because they bought General Dynamics. Back into the F-16...
Wait, when did they buy General Dynamics? I thought at least those two were separate. No.
Uh-uh.
No, what the hell? Do I
don't think so. No, no, maybe I'm wrong. But no,
I need
I
to
don't.
Read more. No, I defer to you on
I
this
think,
for sure.
I think they ended up getting. You know, there's very few defense companies left.
Yeah.
But the thing is that I may be wrong on that. I'm having a little brain freeze on that. I'll have to Google and check. It's happened so many of them, and I just
well,
haven't
I'll instruct the audience to bet on your interpretation.
Well,
not
I don't know.
Mine.
I don't know because I tend to look at it. But anyway, the bottom line is that the DoD is starting to pour more money into the F-16, and possibly coming up with a new version of it because they see how badly this is all failing.
Yeah.
So it's just it's probably it's going to probably end up being the most expensive weapon ever bought.
So. Yeah, well, assuming they ever can finally deploy the things. And now, the way I understood the big fight over the F-22 versus the F-35 was the F-22 is for this fantasy war with China that we can't ever have because they have hydrogen bombs. And so nuts
right.
to that. So what we need is an F-35 so that we can bomb Afghans in their villages where they live.
Well, I mean, that's even unrealistic, too.
Yeah, apparently they can't get the things off the ground. I don't know how they're going to get them to Afghanistan. I guess they could ship them across, in a truck over the Khyber Pass. They can bribe the Pakistanis to let it pass,
Yeah, no, it was interesting that Lockheed didn't fight very hard they fought for a while on the F-22, but then they gave up.
Yeah, so they make both of these planes, and then they do a whole Coke Pepsi thing with them, huh?
Yeah, well, it just ends up being, being a big mess because they know, though, that they could fight it, and that the military really wanted to. What the military probably did behind closed doors was say, "Look, let us kill off, the F-22, but we'll make it up with the, you know, what they call contract nourishment in the F-35. We'll make a lot of times these companies make." We'll still get the same amount of money for what they, you know, their share. So
the military guys
myself.
Always have the best euphemisms for things.
Yeah, I have
contract nourishment.
Yeah, I have to write myself. General Dynamics hasn't been bought by Lockheed. I don't know why I thought that. It was another company that I was thinking of. Well, anyway, they call it, you know, they just know. Really what it comes down to is it's really – that one of the largest, what we call the largest socialistic entities in the universe, is the Pentagon, because it's each according to his needs. They won't let defense contractors go under.
Right.
And so.
Yep.
They always make sure they get enough money.
Yep.
To survive.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we're all out of time. We got to leave it here. But great interview, great work at truthout.org. That's Dina Razor, everybody. Thanks for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Bye bye.
It's called Lockheed, the ultimate pay-to-play contractor at truthout.org right now.